This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have had more drownings, it seems, in Lake Michigan here in Indiana than we have had in recent years. They have always happened, but they seem to be happening in alarming frequency. In fact, the most recent one noted was last weekend as a 32-year-old Michigan man was found drowned in an incident that happened at the lake at the Indiana Dunes State Park. What do we need to know about the importance of water safety in Lake Michigan? Well, you'd think it would be obvious, but maybe not. So that's why we've asked Dave Benjamin, who is the co-founder and he's the executive director of the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project, to join us and give us a primer for the next few minutes about what we should know about the dangers of Lake Michigan, that nice little lake that's on the very end of Indiana, as well as how to handle yourself in it if you get yourself in trouble. As always, Dave, thanks for spending time with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate getting the water safety message out.
Well, we've talked before, and I guess we have to keep talking again. Lake Michigan is not a placid little stream, or a little pond, we should say, that is fed by a stream. It's being fed by a huge water system that in turn turns pretty dangerous sometimes. Tell us about the characteristics of Lake Michigan that if we don't know, we probably should know about.
All right, so the basic characteristics of Lake Michigan is that it is the largest body of fresh water in the United States. From north to south, is about 307 miles long. At its widest point, from east to west, is about 118 miles wide. And when we have wind fetching over the water, it can create waves and several types of dangerous currents. So we can have very dangerous surf conditions, and most people aren't familiar what happens in these surf conditions. We see the waves, they look fun, they are fun to play in, but most people don't put on life jackets. They're, average swimmers or poor swimmers out there wading in the water, jumping in the waves, sandbar breaks down, a rip current opens up, and it can pull them pretty offshore pretty quick. And so we need to get conditions quick. On Lake Michigan, we can have rip currents that pull away from shore. We can have longshore currents that flow parallel to shore. And then we can have structural currents that flow parallel to structures that stick out in the water or piers that stick out in the water. So we can have several types of currents working in concert together when we have waves and dangerous currents.
I know that the National Weather Service always has the advisories out. In fact, we're under one right now for beach hazards conditions because of the rip currents and because of some high waves. And we also know, too, and you've probably seen the information, too, that it seems that Lake Michigan is at the highest level that it has been in a lot of years. And I'm sure that doesn't help either.
The higher water levels definitely does not help. At the same time, though, we've had these high numbers of drownings during low water levels back in 2012. We had, I think, 99 drownings in the Great Lakes. I think 50 of those were in Lake Michigan, and it was low water levels. The number one thing to understand is that water safety is not common sense. Most people do not know that water is one of the leading causes of accidental death in the nation and the world. So whenever you're around any body of water, you need to be hypervigilant. Accidents can happen. Drowning doesn't look like drowning. It's not like how it's portrayed in movies where it's a long traumatic event of yelling and screaming and splashing, that, someone can get in trouble in the water even on calm days. That we need to understand, a person who's drowning, basically facing shore, mouth at water level, head tilted back, their body's vertical, they're doing a climbing a ladder motion, they are likely not able to yell because they're choking on water or they are gasping for air. They can't really wave for help because they put their arm above their head, increases their body weight out of the water, puts their mouth underwater. So, another thing is, a person who's drowning, typically less than 1 minute, and final submersion. So if you don't have your eyes on the water for the people that you're at the beach with, and, you don't see them submerge, you don't see them get in trouble, they can disappear really quick. And then when a person submerges, we need to understand, around 3 minutes of submersion, their heart may stop. Around 4 minutes of submersion, irreversible brain damage begins. And around 10 minutes of submersion, if the person is then pulled out of the water, given rescue breaths and CPR, it's only about a 14% survival rate. So it's a very, very small survival rate. We need to make sure that we're watching people in the water, making sure that we bring flotation with us to the beach, bring U.S. Coast Guard approved life jackets. Life jacket manufacturers should be all over this. every person goes to the beach. They should just bring a life jacket with them. You don't have to wear it 24/7, but bring it with you in case the conditions are choppy or you're unsure of the conditions. Put it on. They're even fashionable these days. You know, wear it. Of the 791 drownings in the Great Lakes now since 2010, only 12 were wearing life jackets. So if you're wearing a life jacket in any of the Great Lakes, you have about a 99% chance of not drowning.
I know that one of these incidents that happened in Valparaiso, there at off Washington Park Beach, you were a witness to, and this was back, I guess, earlier this month, and you actually helped, along with other rescuers, to save a young boy who was apparently the only thing that was probably keeping him in the water was an inflatable duck.
Yeah, that was a horrific experience to participate in. My son and I, my wife and children were at the beach. My son and I were walking down to the pier from the lifeguarded area because we wanted to check out the sandbar formations. The water was calm. It was an offshore wind. And when we got down near the pier, I see a woman about maybe, you know, thigh high, waist high in the water with two young children on an inflatable duck. And the children had arm floaties on, which are terrible ideas for flotation devices for your kids because they can slip off. But anyhow, I was going out to talk to the woman to just, you know, let her know that, you know, offshore winds, these are the hazards. You should bring the duck in. But before I could even get out there, one child jumped off. She turned to grab him. She turned back to put him on the duck, and the duck's floating away. Now she's running after the duck. She can't catch up to it. Now she's trying to swim after the duck. Her fingertips are touching it. And every stroke she took, the duck is getting further and further away. I'm yelling at a boater, trying to get him to, you know, understand what's going on and make a rescue. Now, at this point in time, I'm like, I got to get moving, running about 200 yards to the lifeguard tower to inform them that there's a water emergency, and we got to keep an eye on the duck with the toddler. And then when I look back, there's now two swimmers and a guy in an inner tube all trying to get to this duck far from shore. So I just hopped on my stand-up paddleboard and started paddling out. And at around the same time, a boater got involved in the rescue. He was picking up one of the swimmers. He was about to pick up the inner tuber when I realized, as I'm getting closer, the child fell off the duck. Mm-hmm. And his head is bobbing up and down in the water with these arm floaties, just not keeping his mouth above water. And, you know, we've got, you know, seconds to get to him if he slips under. Luckily, the boat, you know, saw the commotion, what was going on, saw the duck flipping away. He, you know, put on the gas and sped over, and they were able to jump out of the boat and pull this child to safety. And as fast as the whole situation started, it was over, and we all just kind of looked at each other out, you know, about 150 yards offshore. Everyone okay? We got everybody. And then we just went our separate ways. But, you know, I couldn't sleep for days over that, even though the positive outcome. The adrenaline, you know, the running. I'm old, you know. For me to have to run 200 yards to a lifeguard tower, then 100 yards to my truck and to the beach, and then have to paddle out, it wiped me out. And I really couldn't sleep for a couple of days over this.
Well, at least the good news is that it turned out to be, even with all the commotion and all the problems that resulted, it was a happy ending that everybody was saved. But as you said, it happened so quickly. And also, too, I know that the people have always said before, and you probably heard it when you talk with folks giving your lectures on dry land, about the fact that this can happen to anybody, that it doesn't happen to just little kids. It can happen to be happening to experienced swimmers.
And one of the things I want to mention is we just put out a brand new illustration for offshore winds, explaining what they are and how they can be dangerous about a week ago. One of the things that happens quite often when drownings happen is people witness them. They hear about us, and my phone number is out there on the Internet. People will call me to tell me that they witnessed it and what they experienced and what they went through. And sometimes it's almost like a counseling session. But this drowning that just happened at Indiana Dunes State Park, some witnesses called me and told me what they saw, what they believed happened was the guys were out, a group of people were far out on the sandbar, and a ball started to float in the offshore wind, and the guy might have been swimming after the ball and, you know, swam out past his swimming ability, and when he tried to come back to shore, that, you know, he was so far offshore. I mean, it was a far distance for even lifeguards to run out there. They almost got to him, but he had submerged, you know, and hundreds of people witnessed unfortunately someone perished, and hundreds of people probably now have like a traumatic impact, you know, thought of the beach. They'll never look at it the same. You know, some might not go back. It's just, it has a ripple effect. Every drowning we see, and drownings are right again back up to a historic level since we've been tracking the drownings in the Great Lakes since 2010.
Well, Dave, I know that you've mentioned this many times in your lectures, and you've mentioned it here before with us on Regionally Speaking in the past. It always bears repeating, and maybe you can add to it. Well, I know that there are what, at least seven ways to avoid drowning. Why don't you go through the list of things that, I mean, you've mentioned a few of them even here today.
I don't have that complete list off the top of my head. You know, when we teach our water safety presentations, we talk about the big picture of drowning, the nationwide, worldwide statistics, and we narrow it down to who's drowning the most. Some bullet points to understand about connecting the dots of research and statistics is that drowning is one of the leading causes of accidental death in the nation and the world. The World Health Organization calls it a neglected public health issue. 80% of all drowning victims were male because males have a tendency to take risks, more susceptible to peer pressure, more likely to overestimate their abilities. 66% of drowning victims were good swimmers. So good swimmers drown all the time. Mm-hmm. More than half of Americans don't have the basic swimming endurance to survive a water emergency. They know how to swim, but they just don't have the physical, they're just not in shape. You know, you need to understand, you know, swimming is like running. Everyone knows how to run, but people will acknowledge that they don't know how to run a marathon, or they couldn't possibly do it. Swimming needs endurance, and you need to be able to pace yourself. A drowning incident is like a marathon for your life. And so what we advocate, if you're ever struggling in water over your head, is that you flip, float, and follow. Mm-hmm. Flip over on your back and float. Float to keep your head above water. Float to conserve your energy. Float to calm yourself down from the fear and panic of drowning. And then follow a safe path out of the water. Float first, exit strategy second. We acknowledge floating is not the easiest thing, especially in a life and death situation, especially in turbulent waters. But if you want to survive a drowning incident, you must stay at the surface and continue breathing. So you're going to have to do a combination of float, tread water, deep inhalations, deep breaths, hold that air in your lungs, increase your buoyancy. You must stay at the surface and get through that panic attack that a drowning is.
Yeah, that's the most important thing is don't panic, but that's really difficult. It's easy to say when you're on dry land and we're talking as we are, but when you're out there trying to save your own life or help somebody else save their lives, it's pretty important to remember, don't panic. It's just a key to remember. And you mentioned, too, about it, especially if you see somebody struggling in the water, as you have done and others have done, too, to try to get something to the person that floats, so at least it helps them try to stay up out of the water so they don't inhale any water.
Yeah, we recommend that nobody goes in the water to try to make a rescue. When that toddler was out on that inflatable duck went far offshore, you know, I'm experienced with surfing as well as standing up paddle boarding. I had a life jacket on. I had the big 10.5-foot stand-up paddle board. I had a leash attached to my ankle on the paddle board. I also had a whistle on my life jacket. So, I mean, I had the equipment with me. The equipment that I normally go out with all the time. And my biggest concern was not necessarily getting to the boy, but once I get to him, is the wind going to be so strong that I'm not going to be able to get back? But the basic line is we had to provide flotation and then exit strategy second. We knew that, you know, the Coast Guard was being called and that additional boats would be coming soon. So I just had to try to get to him. And luckily the other boater was able to get to him first and save the day.
Well, Dave, thank you for the tips and for telling us about your own personal, and luckily it turned out to be a positive experience, I guess, in a way. Somebody should have learned from what happened to them or to their family members about water safety in particular when you're out in the Great Lakes and here in Northwest Indiana, to be sure. Thank you for spending time with us, and you can always check the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project website and find out more information about how these safety tips will keep somebody alive, maybe yourself sometime. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Dave Benjamin is a co-founder and is one of the chief executives of the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Five extraordinary World War II bomber and fighter aircraft are coming back to Porter County, to the Porter County Regional Airport once again as part of the National Wings of Freedom Tour. And it's a special tour because we're going to be talking about a special reception that'll be coming up here as the aircraft come into Valparaiso. It's a special reception that's going to be held in support of first responders here in Northwest Indiana, and that means it involves the Mack Foundation. And Selena Weatherwax with the Mack Foundation is with us in the studio to talk about it. Selena, thank you for coming in, and welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit first, and from what you've been told by the folks that are actually bringing these planes in, what this year's crop, is, so to speak, is going to be like. They typically like to mix them up. They bring some of the regular ones in all the time, and we'll always, I guess maybe by popular demand, they want to see some of these come in from World War II, and then they always bring some different ones in. And you folks with the Mack Foundation get to have one especially involved with this reception.
We do. The reception will be held on Saturday, August 3rd from 2 to 5 at the airport. And for that special reception, the Collins Foundation is working at bringing in a Hellcat, which was used during World War II. And so for those that come through the reception area in support of first responders, we'll have a firsthand look at what this beautiful aircraft looks like.
Now, I know that they've also put out the note here about the rest of the four that are going to be coming in, as I guess part of what the Valparaiso part of the tour is all about. What have they told you that they're going to be bringing in at the airport that people will get to check out as well?
Well, probably the most popular piece of aircraft that comes in as part of the tour is the P-51 Mustang. That mm-hmm. seems to be the one that people gravitate to. But in addition to that, a P-40 is also scheduled to land during that weekend, as well as a B-17 and a B-24 and a B-25. So it's five different pieces of aircraft that will be here landing on actually next week already.
I think it's remarkable that they not only have five aircraft that actually are flyable. They have to fly them in, obviously, to bring them in. So despite their age, 50-plus years, 60-plus years, even older, they're in perfect working order. These people with the Collins Foundation that set up this tour have worked so hard with all of the people that either are restoring these planes or have restored them and know how to fly them.
Absolutely. And then they also offer flights for the public. There is an expense to it, but there is an opportunity for the public to actually ride in them. And the Collins Foundation has set up this model that is very unique, but also one that that they reference as a living history, a moving exhibit of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there's going to be a very special reception. That's where the Hellcat comes into play to be shown off at the airport in Valparaiso. Tell us what the reception's all about and the proceeds that are going to go toward.
The reception will be held in one of the hangars, specifically the McMillan Family Foundation headquarters. That's where our office is inside that hangar. Mm-hmm. And so inside the airplane hangar, we'll have food and beverages offered to those that come through and purchase tickets. And then we'll also have people driving tractors with wagons back and forth to these airplanes. So because this is an active airport, we certainly don't want people walking on the runway. And so we're offering transportation to and from these other five aircrafts that are going to be on site.
They push history very, very hard. I know with the Collins Foundation, and they're a nonprofit educational organization. That's what they're designed to be able to do. But how do they tend to link together, in particular, with your visit here to Valparaiso to the first responders?
Well, it's a very good question. Bob Collins, Mr. Collins of the Collins Foundation, is mm-hmm. actually originally from Valparaiso. And so that's the local connection there. And we at the McMillan Family Foundation have been very supportive, specifically on the restoration of the P-51. And so because of that connection, they have been very generous in gifting us the tickets or the passes for our guests to go through this living history exhibit and in exchange allow us to raise some funds to support first responder training at the MAC.
Now, speaking of first responder training, that's what the Mac Foundation is best known for here with the operation in Valparaiso. And we've talked before on different occasions about the various facets of training, volunteer and professional firefighter training, for example. And I understand, too, that there is a new addition to the training facility there in Valparaiso that's going to involve canines. Tell us about that.
Yes, we have built a new canine training park. So these canine dogs are out there training with their handlers on a daily basis. There are no set hours for the park, and so we have people that come on midnight shift even to train. So it's been really neat to see.
How long did it take to get this involved, to get this canine park involved? Because you're talking about having to plan ahead, certainly when you talk about training, and we know that the facility there in Valparaiso has been built over time to include all of the components together to be sure that firefighters and other law enforcement and first responders get trained properly. How long did it take to get the canine aspect trained?
That's a very good question, because we're very fast. When we first got word that the National Canine Conference was going to be held in Valparaiso, we got to work. So we really pushed every limit possible to make sure that park was ready for when that conference was held. And that was held in the second week of June. Mm-hmm. So together, the planning, I would say, took maybe 6 months. But the actual execution or construction of took less than 3 weeks because of that tight timeline that we had to meet for that national group to come in.
What kind of facilities are out there and instances that the canines and their handlers have to go through to get the training that they need?
No, they do dogs, vehicle searches. They do drug detection. They even learn on how to find cadavers and body parts. I mean, the A to Z of training for canines is held there.
Wow. So the facility is now pretty much ready for any kind of training that police departments or sheriff's departments here in Northwest Indiana may need to take advantage of to get their canines ready to go out there and do the work that they do every day. And the handlers, for that matter, too, the police officers that are assigned to the dogs have to go through the same training, too. So they probably get their run through, too, I would imagine.
Oh, very much so, because it's very much a team sport between the handler and that canine. So working side by side and working along other teams as well as other dogs, other working dogs, is incredibly important. And so we're able to offer that environment for them to do so.
Now, you mentioned that the organization that puts together, I guess, the programs for training canines had just recently had their event there in Valparaiso. What kind of reaction have you gotten back from people that participated in it and what they think about the new MAC Training Ground Park?
The first reaction, I think the most common reaction, I guess, is the wow factor. People have no idea what's happening at the MAC without seeing it. You know, they think they know, but until you set foot on that campus, that's when you really realize the magnitude or the scope of what we have led here. And so most of them were very surprised by it, and then most of them were also very excited to come back and use the campus for mm-hmm. their training. And these are folks from all over the country.
Yeah. We've talked about the various training facilities there that MAC Foundation has created over time there in Valparaiso, and a lot of the training we mentioned here at the beginning of our conversation dealt with training firefighters, whether they're volunteers or whether they're professional firefighters, to get them ready. A lot of it, I know, has to do with the training that they get, I guess, in addition to whatever training that they have when they go back to their respective fire departments. What kind of training does the fire departments have to go through now? Fire departments, I know, used to have their own training academies, or used to have something was set up, especially bigger cities. And I know you've probably taken over a lot of those duties, and for a lot of small fire departments that couldn't afford to have such a facility.
That's exactly it. So what we were seeing is that there was difference in experience because of that, right? A department that was leading their own training, and they still have to do quite a bit of that anyways, but for them to lead an academy is really unfeasible. It's mm-hmm. just, it doesn't make any economic sense to do so. And so by us offering the classes where they're all invited to come through the MAC, one facility, we offer the infrastructure. Not only is it a significant cost savings for departments, but an obvious cost savings to taxpayers and municipalities as well.
Now, getting back to the event coming up here on Saturday, August 3rd, at the airport, involving, of course, the World War II aircraft and the very special a reception that's going to be held there with the MAC. If anybody's interested in attending in this and like to get some of these commander passes, as they're called, how can they find out more?
Well, I would encourage them to call here, Lakeshore Public Media, because you are one of our generous sponsors, but also the MAC Foundation, a website. It's MAACFoundation.com. And on the website, the main page has a link, and people could order their tickets online, or they could call us as well.
Selena, thank you for coming by today and telling us all about this. And we hope that the big event coming up on Saturday the 3rd is very successful.
Thank you, Chris.
And that's Selena Weatherwax. She's with the MAC Foundation based in Valparaiso. The Indiana Parenting Institute, which is based out of Northwest Indiana, is having a big expo coming up. We'll find out about it and how the nonprofit organization is doing in general. In studio with us, we have Jenna Beleza, who is with the senior staff of the IPI. We're going to have the IY on later.
So
I'm having both organizations on the program today, but we're starting out with the IPI. And thank you for being with us, Jenna.
Thank you for having us back. I enjoy being here with you. And so any opportunity that you give me to spend some time with you, I appreciate. So thank you.
It's programs like the IPI and the IYI that are so focused in on Hoosier youth and the well-being of youth in particular.
Exactly.
What does the IPI seem to benefit the most? Does it benefit youngsters as much as parents, or is it about equal?
Well, we benefit youngsters by working with their parents. You know, I just think that parenting is such an interesting vocation that we find ourselves thrust into, you know, because we're responsible for the upbringing of another human being. And if we want our children's well-being, the parents need to be well prepared to ensure that that happens. And so we decided to take on that role, and we leave getting the data and information and the resources necessary for you specifically to IYI.
Do you find that that the Indiana Parenting Institute probably relies maybe more than other organizations do in having licensed and expert people out there in the community to help parents along, along with the experience of the staff that you have?
Oh, definitely. I just think that we need to be a community, right? And so I think a lot of times parents will get into or families, I should say, will get into circumstances and feel like they're isolated and alone and having to figure it out. And one of the things that we like to help our families realize is that you're part of a community and how to access that community to get those resources or services that you need to help you get through whatever challenge your family's going through or situation that you're needing help with that you've done all that you can think of to do.
Do you think that it's a case where, I guess, if people know that you're out there and that they will take advantage of the services, that will in turn give them a little more confidence in being better parents? Maybe if they had questions, maybe they haven't gotten the right advice all along or along the way, that they'll ask for help and they'll get it?
You know, what's very interesting is unfortunately there's a stigma around parenting education, which I am very adamant about removing, which is there is never... It's never a punishment to learn more than you already know. And so it's not a matter of that you're a bad parent. It's a matter of that you're an uninformed parent. And there's so much that has changed, even within the last 30 years, I would say, with regards to parenting, that, you know, you can't use the old stuff, the old methodologies to deal with the today problems, because a lot of the today problems, that stuff didn't even exist. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to know that as a parent that there's a place that I can go and get questions answered. You know, like, my child's involved with this now, and I don't really know how to address that. You know, do you have any ideas that you can share with me on how to do that? I would like for parents to stop looking at a parenting class or a parenting education as a label saying that you're not a good parent, but that in fact it is a label saying that you are a good parent, because you're going out there to find the information that you need to best service your children.
I know that it has been said in some promotional material, and you've probably seen it, heard it too. It's kind of sounds kind of snarky, but there's somebody saying out there, there's no instruction manual that comes with a baby.
There is no instruction manual, and just look at how many of us were raised by the throw of the dice, I want to call it. You know, so,
yeah.
And there's so much research, there's so much out there about what impacts a child. There's this whole thing about the stages of development and certain behaviors that we think are even rebellious are actually necessary for the development of certain skills that we need as adults, you know? And so having parents understand that allows them to realize that what I thought was going on here is really, this is what I need to do to encourage what it's trying to develop in my child. And an example I like to give parents is when a child is going through what we call the terrible twos, what's their favorite word? And the word is no. And I said the reason that they're saying no is because at the age of two, they're learning how to make decisions. And so what's the word that they hear most from their parents? No. So that's how they're expressing their decision by. So if parents telling them to do something, they're not saying no to be rebellious. They're saying no to say that that's not their choice. Do you know? And so having that understanding as a parent, then you can address that process differently than feeling like the kid just said no to me and how dare my child say no to me. You know, and it's that kind of researched information that we can share with parents so that they don't find themselves inhibiting development in their children by a misconception of what's going on.
So if they heard more yeses than noes, then that would turn things around, or you would think so, right?
Right, or understanding how the child is processing those noes so that they could balance it with yeses.
Now, we've come up with all of this to the point now that the IPI is getting ready for another annual Parent Expo. The 2019 Northwest Indiana Parent Expo is going to happen on August 17th. It's going to happen, is it going to be a combination at the Ivy Tech Community College and the IU Northwest campuses? They're all the same.
Actually, it's going to be at the Arts and Sciences Building, which both universities or college and university are located there. Mm-hmm. But we've changed the name. It was Parent Expo last year. It's now going to be the Northwest Indiana Education Expo, because that's really what it was about, was informing our parents about the education process. And this year, I felt that it was highly needed because this is the beginning of the graduation pathways. The new Indiana Department of Education graduation requirements start with this year's eighth graders. And so it's very important for parents and even educators. We're inviting educators to this one as well because you need to understand what is now required for your students to graduate, and it's a lot different. The emphasis now is on getting students prepared for being adults, for working, for finding what their purpose and direction in life is, and how through that purpose, through that job, through that career, they're going to contribute to their communities. And so I also serve on the governor's workforce cabinet, and I love that that's the direction that we're moving in, because mm-hmm. I like to tell the story about my first workforce cabinet meeting, and there was a gentleman there from Salesforce who was saying that the education system had let down industry because you're producing folks that aren't prepared to work in our industries. And I went, and I had an aha moment, and I was dumbfounded because I didn't realize that's what education was for. I didn't realize that education was there to prepare me for the future that I decided that I wanted to do. Instead, I just knew I had to get to college, and that somehow by osmosis, in college, I'd figure out life, as opposed to knowing that it's a preparation process and that education helps you to get to where you get to decide where you want to go. You know, and so that is now with the graduation path. Ways they're calling these new graduation requirements is what we're trying to instill in families moving forward so that kids are better prepared to know what their future is.
Are there some programs, workshops and all that are going to be planned for the big event coming up here next month there on campus that will help educate the educators?
Well, one of the things, the three topics that we're discussing at the expo this year are dual credit and credentials, a great tool in getting your children prepared to go into that next stage of life. We call it post-secondary. Post-secondary, by the way, is no longer just college. It's about college or credentials or whatever you choose to do after high school that moves you closer to the direction of your career.
Yeah, I mentioned the workforce development. People are very, very keen to let people know that there's no requirement that you have to go to college after high school.
Right, you don't.
If you can, that's great. But there are lots of, in fact, maybe probably even better opportunities that maybe for some people, if they go ahead and follow through with the right kind of technical training mm-hmm. or some kind of professional training after high school.
And plus, we also want to instill the concept of lifelong learning, because even if I choose to be a welder, for example, and go and get a certification after high school rather than going to a four-year college, I, in my welding career, may decide that I want to be a manager, that I'm really good at managing, and then I could go back to university, you know, and then get that management degree. So it's lifelong learning. It's not just get the four-year degree, get the job, and go.
Mm-hmm. besides these particular discussions you're having, which are based around the workforce development issue and planning for the future, what else is going to come up at the expo this year?
So let me give you the I'm going to finish the other one. So the other thing is, too, is your voice, school rules, your rights and responsibilities. We just want parents to understand what their role is in the education process, because they do have one. And also to understand what to expect from the education process, you know, because I think a lot of times you aren't able to get the best of that experience, out of that experience for your children if you're unaware. And so we want to make sure the parents are aware. And then also school choice, that there's a lot around the concept of school choice, not just where you go, but how your child gets educated, and just making sure parents know that they have a lot more power, they have a lot more influence in that decision and in what in ensuring that their child gets what's best for them than they think. Most parents think that they're just subjective to whatever the school system says, and they have so much more input to put into it, and we want them to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. And so then it's just after that, it's just a matter of getting to know what resources in the community are out there to help you achieve the things that you're looking for, that your student is looking for, to get to that adulthood and be a contributing member of society. So,
are there any groups that are going to be offering information? You know, it seems that that conferences oftentimes like this will have time, of course, built into the program to give people a chance to get breakaways and breakaway sessions and the like, and go out and talk with people maybe out in the atrium, wherever it happens to be. Organizations coming in, like the IPI, coming in to talk to people, offering up information for those who are attending.
Like last year, we're partnering with Merrim Health Center, who does a back to school health fest. So our event is from 9 a.m. to noon, and then you would leave our event, go a block north to their outdoor event, to their health fest, which is an outdoor event where there's going to be all kind of community service vendors. So you'll get to see all of the resources that are in the community related to education and health that you can access. Because you know, part of health is that you got to get immunized. You know, you got your immunizations and your physicals for school. So you've got all that information that's out there. They're also going to be giving away back-to-school supplies, backpacks for students for free. There's going to be music. It's just like it turns into like a community celebration block club type of a thing. And so I just wanted to make it fun. So you're getting information about your students' education moving forward, starting with the eighth graders this year, and then going out and just meeting your community, connecting with resources, getting free food. They're going to feed everybody. And
that's good. Music that'll attract
more people,
too. Yes, I imagine that,
giveaway, too. Tons of giveaways. Yeah. I mean, we're just trying to make it a fun afternoon. And that goes, they're going to start their part at 11, and that goes until 2. So there is a crossover. So if you don't really want to come to the expo, you can just go to the other event. But we would hope that you want to come to the expo to learn about these new graduation requirements, because they are extensive in terms of what's expected of your students now in order to get that diploma.
If there's any separate information about the expo itself, where can they find it now?
You can go to our website. There's a link on the which is www.indianaparentinginstitute.org. There is a link. There is a graphic for it, and if you click on that, it'll send you to our Eventbrite page, which goes more into detail about it. Mm-hmm. And again, the event is free. Both events are free, by the way. And you just click on the little button that says free, and you can get signed up. So. The event is on Saturday, August 17th from 9 a.m. to noon. So just make sure you guys get registered, because we will gladly accept walk-ups, but we'd like to know you're coming so we can make sure that we have enough continental breakfast for everybody, because we will feed you too.
We've talked about now this event coming up on August 17th. What other events are planned going into the start of another school year for the Indiana Parenting Institute?
One of the things that we're looking to do in October is the State of the Family Luncheon. So you know how you have the State of the City, State of the State, those kind of things. We want to do a State of the Family where we just talk about what's going on with family today in Northwest Indiana, and just letting people understand what the state of family is, what are the major concerns of family, what's being done about those concerns, what are some benefits available to families today, and how to access those benefits. So I don't have the date for that one here with me. That's also on our website. It's right under the graphic for the Education Expo. But I will probably be reaching out to you to come back on and give you more information. We'll probably have you back on closer to that.
Because it's in October. we'll remind people about that, because if you have registration and all for that, then you'll have to have a deadline to be able to meet on that as well, too. And once again, all of this information, especially about the upcoming Educator Expo that is going to happen at the Ivy Tech Community College at IU Northwest, your session is going to be in the Arts and Sciences Building on the Gary campus, is all on the IPI website.
So right.
It's all there if you want to check it out. Yeah.
And I just want to thank Ivy Tech and IUN for their contributions to this, because they are partners in this as well as Merrim Health Center. So,
Gina, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the importance of taking advantage of the right kind of education as we're all going through life, trying to raise family members and all. And going back to that snarky remark that there's no instruction manual that comes when a young person is born.
Oh my goodness.
You have to kind of get the help you can and take advantage of the advice that you can get out
there,
too. Jenna, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Jenna Belesa is one of the staff members and chief executive staff members, actually, of the Indiana Parenting Institute, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Indiana Youth Institute takes its time going very carefully through all of the measures that it may consider from a legislative session that is wrapped up, like the one this year, especially if they are topics that may pertain to not only the benefits but the detriment of Hoosiers young people. And they have a chance to put together at least their look at the bills that have made it into law and the ones that got considered. And for all this, we bring in Tammy Silverman. She's the president and CEO of the IYI. Tammy, as always, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me back.
Well, a lot of measures made it through the session, at least got reviewed. Some got passed into law. Some just kind of fell by the wayside. Tell us about the ones that that you all kept very close eye on at the IYI this past session.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, since it was a budget session, we were watching the dollars, right? Because you can often tell how relative importance by looking at the investments of the budget dollars. So school funding did increase 2.5%, and that's the highest level of funding that the DOE has had for public schools in over a decade. So that we consider a positive step forward, and at the same time, we know that some folks, there were some things that did not get funded even with that increase that are still being studied this summer. We saw some additional programs like the Next Level Jobs Employer Training Program, which is a huge mouthful, that got some additional funds, as well as probably the big one that everyone's talking about is the increased funding for the Department of Children's Services.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we often get asked, is that enough? And time will tell with that one.
I know that some of the other issues that you had a chance to look at and the bills when they came up and came up for review, and that as one that had passed as well, kind of fit into various categories. Take us through the listing that you folks at the Indiana Youth Institute have on the measures that you were watching in particular that did make it through this session.
Sure. So we kind of look in a few big buckets, right? We look at family and community and education and economics. So family and community, there was a new bill that was passed that went into effect just a little bit ago that related to homeless youth. And it was helping to make sure that anyone helping a homeless teen, it's often teens, can help them get the identification, the government ID that they need, as well as help them access educational services. So we hope that that will help streamline the process for kids and teens, youth and teens that are homeless, as well as there was a new family and community kind of related bill that had to do with parents who are incarcerated. And so what this bill did was it stipulates that DCS needs to work with, assuming the parent has been a positive role model for that child and has had a meaningful role in the child's life, that they still incorporate that into their case plan if the parent is incarcerated. So both those things we think were big moves forward, as well as a couple other education bills that were out there.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of education, what were the measures that you all kept a close eye on and turned out to be ones to watch in the future?
Certainly. There was a tremendous amount of activity around school safety. So a lot of those had to do with the stop arm on school buses, obviously, and that one was really in response to the tragic incident in northern Indiana where the three children were killed by somebody going around. It strengthens some of those laws, and you know, we want to make sure that those are in place. In addition, there are some bills that were passed that had to do with kind of the mechanics of school safety. I would say, you know, metal detectors, wands, those kinds of things. The one that we find the most promising had to do with social and emotional well-being of the kids. So we're hoping that in addition to the immediate safety needs, we're also going to try to look at and start to really dive deeper into what are the root causes. Why are kids showing up at school wanting to demonstrate destructive behaviors or cause harm? And hopefully we can start to address some of those underlying issues. We know the Department of Education is doing a lot of curriculum work around that, and some of these bills reflected that as well.
I understand there's also one measure that you watch very closely this time around involved high schools and being able to teach high school students the importance of citizenship by actually making them learn the naturalization exam, which is the same thing that people coming new to our country get to go through to become citizens.
You're absolutely right, Chris. So now that will be required to be part of the U.S. government course. Every Indiana student is required to take a U.S. government course. And that exam will be part of it. In addition, as far as the U.S. history course, the bill is also that there was a new bill that required the study of the Holocaust across Indiana U.S. history courses. So both of those are new requirements that just went into effect July 1st.
One other measure that you all had watched closely at the IYI and made it through the General Assembly session was a proposed bill that would involve juvenile justice. What's that all about?
Right. And so this bill came out, and it had proposed that it would allow children as young as 12 to be waived into adult court after serious charges, particularly attempted murder, were filed. And it really met with a lot of opposition, and really rightfully so, because the research has been that children's brains are developing at a later age, not a younger age. And many of our neighboring states and states around the country are actually moving those ages up for children to be included into adult court. That doesn't mean that they don't need to be held accountable by any stretch of the imagination, but understanding that there is a difference between youth brain development and adult brain development was really what caused a lot of that opposition to that bill.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman with the Indiana Youth Institute about the measures that the IYI has been watching very closely as the General Assembly session went through its motions and wrapped up this year. One other measure, or group of measures, I suppose, that I know that you all were looking closely at, you might have mentioned it earlier in the conversation here, was dealing with the Department of Child Services and operational bills, I guess, that came up. What was that? What were those, I should say, that you were the most interested in?
Right. And so there's going to be continued scrutiny. There has been scrutiny on the Department of Children's Services, and it's going to continue for the near future. There were two bills that covered several activities, really pushing DCS to make sizable improvements. And those centered around some of their activities, including new standards for the response time that are required, caseload limits, response activities, the maximum age for collaborative care, all of those different things, and those bills also required that a comprehensive report be filed to the General Assembly by a year from now, so by July 1st, 2020. So again, they're investing a lot of dollars into making some of those needed overhauls and upgrades at DCS, and at the same time, they really drill down into what the expectations are, including a report back to the General Assembly.
I know we're talking during the summer months, and of course that means baseball season, and I suppose there are, I guess, some draws that you can make to not only the hits that have come about and the ones measures that you have seen take place that will be of greatest benefit to Hoosier young people, but there are some misses too. And I know there's one in particular that you were all very concerned that should have passed but didn't. Tell us about that.
It didn't, and I love your baseball analogy, Chris. That's great this time of year. So, of course, we had hoped that there would be some movement on two bills that were up that had to do with nicotine use. So one was to increase the state smoking age to 21, and the other was to raise the cigarette tax, what some folks are calling the user tax for cigarettes. Right now, ours is the lowest in the Midwest. And we know that 9 out of 10 smokers start before the age of 18. So this is really a youth health issue. We know that this is going to come up again next session without a doubt. And, in fact, many of our folks, even at the national level, are talking about increasing the smoking age to 21.
I see. Now, during the summer months here, we have summer study committees that the General Assembly is in. Lawmakers are involved in many of these topics. Which are the ones that you at the IYI are keeping the closest watch on?
Yes, we have two that we're really tracking closely. One has to do with the courts and the judiciary, and it's really focusing on some of the adjudication and rehabilitation of juvenile offenders and some of the work being done there. Like we talked about before, that there was that bill that did not pass. They're going to continue working and making sure that hopefully the rehabilitation, particularly amongst our youth of color, is proportional and that we're doing all we can to rehabilitate youth offenders. The second one has to do with the Education Interim Study Committee, and that will look at the impact of school counseling programs as well as their associated funding. Also, still taking up that issue of teacher pay, which, again, was that little tidbit I said earlier. Even though Department of Ed funding went up, there was a lot of folks that were frustrated that teacher pay did not get more attention or funding this session.
Well, Tammy, what takeaway can you offer from the IYI about all the measures that came up during the General Assembly session, the ones that passed, the ones that didn't?
Well, we're glad that our elected officials are talking about the child well-being throughout our state, and we hope that they continue to do so, and we're going to keep asking them to do so and providing them with data and research. At the same time, we know that we continue to be ranked 29th in the country, and there's more work to be done. So, yes, we're glad that there was time and attention, but our work's not done until every Hoosier child can reach their full potential.
Tammy Silverman is president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. In the news this week, a hacker accessed information on 100 million Capital One customers. And in some ways, this is actually a cyber defense success story.
Capital One identified and traced the breach in a span of 4 months. IU cybersecurity program chair Scott Shackelford says that's a stark contrast to the just-settled Equifax breach 2 years ago.
Equifax is a great case study in what not to do. The trickle of information that came out was slow. They tried to basically show, maybe this wasn't as big deal as we initially thought. Led to believe, but it turns out that they basically lost the personally identifiable information of the vast majority of Americans.
Shackelford says banks generally have stronger defenses than other industries, in part because they've teamed up for a joint cybersecurity center. Eric Berman, Network Indiana.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on our program, we'll have conversations, including one with Joseph Pete, who is the Times business reporter and writer. Hope you can join us.